And then they settled down with a Scotchman, Max somebody or other. He was about the fifth attempt they made. And he turned out all right. And then from then on, they progressed. They were more careful in their choice, you see. But some of them went up like rockets. You see, this is what you got to understand about a war footing. A war footing in a thing like that is this. That war breaks out, and you have a small force, let's say 1,000 in the Air Force. Well, the headquarters immediately arrange as to what the future is going to be.
It'd be like a planning operation.
A planning operation. What is the future going to be? We're going to have so many group captains, so many wing commanders, so many this.
Right.
I knew a lad who was, when I joined, was a corporal in the pay department. And he was a smart lad, a corporal. Mm-hmm. And in 3 months, he was a wing commander. In 3 months he was a wing commander. Got up, ladder. And you see, in the case of a pay department, you can't handle a sum of money over a certain amount unless you're a certain rank.
Of course.
I'll tell you something funny about that, if you like.
Sure.
Did I tell you about the colonel in the who built the Alaska Highway? Did I tell you that episode? Because this is rather funny. I'll give you an idea how stupid you can be in the Air Force. My officers were in the Royal Bank Building in Vancouver. I had a hall of the sixth floor.
This is when you're doing the radio show and the... Everything like that, yes.
And beneath me was the colonel in charge of building the Alaska Highway.
This is the American colonel.
Yeah.
And this would be what, 41, 42, or 42?
42. It would be 42, 43. 42, the Americans 43. Had just come in and they were building this. And he came into my office every morning for a cup of coffee at 10 o'clock, you see, and he'd have a talk, you see. So I'm in my office talking to him when my orderly room sergeant major walks in. And he said, "Sir, I want you to sign these vouchers." And he put the voucher book on my thing and he said, "You better sign three times, sir." He said, "For these three different vouchers and their copies." So I signed them. And this American watched me with amazement. And he said, "What was that about?" Well, I said, "I had to order some rubber stamps from Ireland and Allen up the street there." And I said, "There were three of them. And they were $14.50 for the three stamps." And I said, "So he had to make out three vouchers because I can only spend out of petty cash $5 at a time." He said, "For Christ's sake." He said, "Why, you're the same rank as I am." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I can spend $1 million without question."
The Americans. Of course.
He said, "Good God, I can spend $1 million without
question." There's nothing a colonel could spend that.
He had that authority. I can spend $5.
$5.
That's the difference between Canada and the United States, you know. I always thought that was a very funny story. And one of my fellows was traveling around the country for something in a Jeep. And his Jeep broke down near where they were building the Alaska Highway. So he went into one of their big encampment places, you know, and asked the commanding officer if they could mend his Jeep, if something had gone wrong with it. So they had a look at this Jeep, and he said, "Oh, Christ," he said, "there's no good fiddling around with that. Take one of those over there, but give it to..." And he took away the Jeep. That was the power they had. It was absolutely unlimited, but it got things done. And, you know, if you look at this sensibly, they make a colonel out of you, a wing commander, whatever it is, and they give you rank. Well, why not give you the authority to uncan you if you don't behave yourself, you see?
So you're saying, though, that RCAF headquarters and directives, whatever, interdepartment memo, whatever you want to call it, they were so structured And they had it set so much that even as a wing commander, you were only allowed to sign $5 at a time. And that if you wanted anything done, it had to go to committee and had to be approved. And it had to all
go through all the red tape all the way. Oh, I'll tell you another funny story about that I got into trouble with. This office I had in Kingston, you see, was above some shops.
Now this is Kingston now.
For 1940, just going back to 1940. Okay. And I've gone up, I'm in this office, and I'm working late at night. I go down my steps and slam the door, and the lock breaks. Yay, lock. So I thought, for God's sake, I've got to get this office tied up. So I go down the street and wake up a locksmith running a hardware store. And I told him the story, and he said, I'd bring a lock right now. So we went back, and we put the lock on the door, and he gave me the keys.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, I write, I said, look, this is the Air Force, you know, so you'd better give me a receipt for the money that I've paid you in quadruplicate, so I can get it back. Right. And he said, sure. So he gave me four. So I send these four in to the paymaster and asked to be recompensed for the money I'd spent. He wrote me a letter, and it said that, didn't I realize that I had broken every regulation in the book, that in a case like that, I should have immediately sent to the Army Engineers, and the Army Engineers would have sent a man to verify that the lock was broken, and he would give me the verification. I would then take the verification and get in touch with three lock people who would accept the lowest bid, you see? And I read this letter in fury, you see? I wrote back and I said, I have noted your letter at such and such a date, and what the hell was I supposed to do? Stand on the doorstep and hold the door shut? Well, I get another letter back, and it said, we are astounded at your temerity in writing such a letter to headquarters, and if anything further of this nature occurs, you will be severely disciplined.
But this is crazy. This is wartime. I mean, I can see how it, in peacetime checks and balances.
Yeah, but it isn't peacetime anymore.
This is 1940. Yeah. You're up to your ears in war.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Now, do you think this is part and parcel? I don't know if this is fair, but do you think this could be part and parcel with the government's attitude, or particularly the Mackenzie King type attitude towards the armed forces? In that he didn't want to commit himself fully, I guess.
No, you see, in all my experiences out here in this country, I found that the red tape in the services in this country was crazy in comparison with the British Army. The British Army were years ahead in certain phases, and though they're the slow enough, so help me God.
Well, they're 400 years of tradition unhampered by progress.
Yeah, you see? But they were far ahead of here in certain, in using your own initiative. For instance, you take when I joined the Mounted Police. They were still mounting guard over the horses at night, just as if they... It was 1880 with the Indian War on. You went on stable duty armed with a revolver. You know, nuts. And you weren't allowed out after 10 o'clock at night. You had to be in bed at 10, quarter to 10. And here you are, policemen, supposed to be up upholding the law. They can't trust you to be out after quarter to 10. I found that...
How did anything get done in headquarters? I mean, if you had all these regulations and all these little directives, and you had people, in your opinion, people who were not up to the job in the early part of the war...
You could... what I would do was to slide around the red tape in any possible way I could.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, why didn't you say, like, go to Powers or someone like that? Who you were fairly good terms with.
I did on occasion. I told you before about going to him about this commissioning business. I believe I told you that.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not sure.
Yes, we said it on another tape, but... I found people were using influence to get commission.
Ah, yes.
I told you about that, and I went to him, well, he just stopped it at once, gave me permission to stop it at once. So if it came to their notice and you could give a good case, I think you could...
But was there that much of it? I mean, it was just
routine. Oh, well, there always is. For instance, now look, I was assistant director of Manning, and then I became director of Manning.
This is after Bishop, or...?
This is towards the... You know, in 1943, I became assistant director of Manning.
Okay.
In March of 44, I became director of Manning.
Mm-hmm.
My duties were entirely opposite to each other. As director of Manning, I was manning the Air Force. As assistant director of Manning, I was preparing demobilization proceedings.
So you got these reversed.
Exactly reversed. So I used to have to write letters to myself to keep track of everything that was done. I'd write to myself and say, we won't need any so many aero engine mechanics. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And so we better close that school. And then I'd write back to myself and say, well, it's done. See, I had to keep a record both ways because it would have been lost. Sounds fantastic, but there it is.
Only thought Bismarck did that.
You know, well, if you've got two jobs,
you've
got different hats. Yes. And what are you going to do? You've got to keep records, and you've got to... So the only way to do it is to write to yourself.
Headquarters didn't really expand. Now, you were in these very small
quarters. Oh, yes. No.
They did expand. They had a new building, but you didn't move into that.
We didn't move into it. We were the old brigade. They wanted to stay. We were the old-timers. And also, we got to remember that the ones that I was with, they weren't from outside the Air Force at all. They were all Air Force people when I got there.
I see.
You follow? Well, then you make all these enormous enlistments and everything, and you build up new officers. Well, they were all in the other block, the big new building. We were still in the old spot, three or four floors in an old building, which was very nice. We were out the way, because all the big shots were...
The new one,
Jack. Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Oh, yeah, we were stuck to that place like you. I loved Jackson Building, it was called. I loved it because there wasn't the spit and polish that you had in the big new building, you see. The big new building with guards and sentries and all the rest of it floating around.
That right, eh?
Mm-hmm. All protocol, you know, whatever you move.
What was security like during this point? Like you had in the early part of 1940, you had direct access to any information you wished.
Yeah.
Now was security a major problem here, or what was the deal?
Well, you've got to remember this. I've never mentioned this before, but in those early days, and for some considerable time, every person who applied for the Air Force as a commissioned officer was investigated three ways. One by the Mounted Police, one by that credit association, and a third one by, there were two, what do you call those, Dun and Bradstreet.
Yes.
They were one, and another credit association was the other. And they had a dossier on you an inch thick before you were in there. They knew your record, your personal habits, and everything about you. There was no chance of staying at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, once they had you like that, they knew they could trust you. I mean,
did you work on a need-to-know basis at this point? A need-to-know basis? Like, if you didn't need to know, you didn't hear about it.
You
worked on that?
Yeah.
I was wondering...
And you just kept your mouth shut. I mean, it's automatic, especially someone like me, you've served in the services, all of that. Your loyalty becomes fantastic. Too much so, perhaps. And yet it's necessary, and you become that way.
Everything under control?
You'd mentioned to me before that you would act, didn't make friends at this period.
I didn't make any friends.
And
I didn't have a friend at all. I didn't go around with anybody, I just worked.
And this, you know, where I gather where others were like you in that sense, and that the job was
over. Well, there was a Toronto clique.
Yes.
They're always it.
Yes.
And they hung together like glue, and even lunchtimes were play gin rummy together, and drink and play gin rummy and poker in the evening and everything. But I didn't have anything to do with anybody. I kept myself entirely to myself. And I got a name. I didn't found out that I had it until I left the Air Force. But I was known as the Buccaneer. They used to refer to me as the Buccaneer.
Why is that?
I don't know. But I didn't know.
A bit of a pirate? Or?
I don't know, but that was what they used to call me, the Buccaneer. I think it was, I didn't give a damn for any of them.
Yeah.
You see, I just didn't care. I told you, when in 43, they decided they wanted to be at Air Force Headquarters Assistant Director of Manning.
This is after the radio program business, yes. This is after the
radio.
The radio program is also another duty?
That was 43. That was another duty. But they wanted me out there, and they went to see the director of personnel, the High Muckabut, Air Marshal Sully, and they told him they wanted me in Air Force Headquarters. And he said, "That goddamn man," he said, "I wouldn't have him down here at any price." He said, "Every time he's set eyes on me, he's contradicted me." Yeah, it was rather funny. But I did. If they were wrong, I suddenly would have said so. I didn't care what rank they were, or a journal tell you, I was always like that. I can't bear stupidity. I just can't bear it. It's something that in me that absolutely fights the moment that I get a stupid order or a stupid. I just say, it's nuts. No, you can't do it. For instance,
I gather there was a lot of stupid orders. Is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Because I told this Sully once, he sent out an order to the director of Manning, saying that there was too many individual letters being written, and that they could all be covered by form letters. Everything could be covered by form letters. And he said this openly in a big meeting, and I just stopped and said, "Yeah, that's stupid, you can't do it." I said, and I went through cases where it just would not work. And he was absolutely white with rage when I'd finished. But the form letter didn't go through, I won my point. He just bloody wouldn't. And yet, you see, when I ended, I was a white-haired boy.
Yeah.
I fought him on these points, and he suddenly turned and gave me his autographed picture, which is hanging up downstairs. Because I never lost a point, ever. I just couldn't. You people, you see, they're afraid of rank. I wasn't, because I didn't give a goddamn. I mean, I didn't, as I told him, I said, I made my living before I got in the Air Force, and I can go out and get it again.
You weren't a career officer yet.
No, I didn't. I didn't give a hoot. And it was, there was so much of this ass kissing that it was painful to me to watch it.
You mentioned that before in headquarters. Yeah. I think your expression. And, so many people trying to get ahead. Or?
Yeah, that's right. And it's what they would do. What I actually saw one man. He was at a desk some distance from me, and I saw him pick up the telephone, and he rang up Air Vice Marshal Sully. Well, the director of personnel, you see, has power over everything, commissioning, rank, everything.
Right.
So he's a very important man. This fella got hold of the phone and said, oh, sir, I hear that...
Hold on for a moment, sir. Could you touch the microphone and it'll make a lot of racket. Yeah. Sorry, sir.
He said, oh, sir, I hear that you're having a special party tonight. And he said, I thought I'd just ring you and tell you that your flat is... I know your flat is very small, and I've got this large house that... he said, and I think... if you'd like to have your party in my house, well, there's lots of room. You're quite welcome. And also, he said, I know, Wes, I can get you a case of scotch. See? Well, it gave me a pain in the rear end, you see. And, of course, when the promotion list comes out, he gets promoted.
And you heard this?
Oh, yeah. I heard all this on the bloody phone. And it was... Constant. As I say, when I got to Ottawa headquarters, whole sections that were being formed consisted of nothing but Torontonians who knew each other, had been to university together, just masses of them. And it got so bad that when Chubby Powers became Minister of Air, he divided the country up and only would allow commissioning pro rata of
population. Yes.
And, you know, God, if it hadn't been for him, the whole bloody Air Force, being, every ranking officer would have been from Toronto. Or Ontario.
In the Air Force headquarters there now, you wouldn't be doing too much with overseas, is that correct?
Very little.
I guess you had enough, not that you didn't have enough to do in Canada. I mean, you had Western, Eastern, and Central Air Command, the British Air Commonwealth Training.
Yeah, everything. You see, it was, it was fantastic. We had about half a dozen manning pools with thousands of people in them, you know. And there's always a lot of trouble. You can't very well avoid it, court martials and one thing. There's trouble, you know, there's a terrific amount of stuff goes on. And there was one very fine fellow that I knew, and I've forgotten his name. I regret very much that I've forgotten his name, but he was like me, a rebel in his old way, and very brilliant man. And he saw something in the Air Force he didn't like and objected to, and nobody took any notice. And he wrote an open letter to the Toronto Globe and Mail and pointed this whole thing out, this bad business in the Air Force.
And you don't remember the incident itself?
No, I don't. You know, there's so many.
Yes.
But they told him to resign. He resigned.
Yeah, but that's bad form to go outside of the service.
Oh, I'll tell you another funny story. There was a chap in Air Force headquarters that I loathed. On sight. He was the man that complained to me about my work, and I told him to stick the basket up his rear end.
He was a group captain, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Was the name was?
No, he wasn't a group captain. His boss was. He was a squadron leader.
Squadron leader.
And Miguel, his name was. And he was an absolute louse, and he hated me. And I didn't understand why he hated me so much. I mean, I was doing a bloody job, but he did. And he was the one that got me pushed out onto this traveling backwards and forwards, you see, because it was on top of my answering the chief of air staff back, you see.
And it's Croyle.
Yeah, Croyle back, answering back. And this happened on top of it, and so they put me out. We'll be through in a minute, then we'll have tea. And anyway, he was a homosexual, and nobody knew it. And by God, if he didn't write some love letters to a young clerk, a lad, and an officer found them under this lad's blotter. And he was immediately put under arrest, confined, and he was court-martialed, and was tried and kicked out, rooted out of the Air Force. But the amusing part was that the then Chief of Air Staff, and I can't remember his name again, there were so many,
yeah,
but he was a very fine fellow, and I forget, he was pacing up and down the corridor saying this, "How dare they do this to my Air Force? How dare they do this to my McGill, how dare they do this to my Air Force?" And he was, oh, it was a very personal problem.
Tea will be up in 5 minutes.
Well, okay, dear. Take a break right now.
Yeah.